Vectis Radio.
Welcome to Maggie Talks To, a series of in-depth conversations with people who live and work here on the Isle of Wight.
I'm here today with Karen Robb.
Hello, Maggie.
Hello.
Hello.
And what does Karen Robb do?
Karen Robb, it depends what day it is. Sometimes I'm teaching people how to sew. Sometimes I'm in a shop selling sewing machines and demonstrating those. Sometimes I'm working on my own projects, which is going to be my own patterns for people to make their own garments.
Right, interesting. So were you actually born here on the island?
No, actually born in Croydon, South London, South London girl. Moved over in 2000, so I've been here just over a quarter of a century now.
Okay, and did you go to school in Croydon?
Yes.
Did you like school?
No. No.
What didn't you like about it?
School was okay. I just, because I was a creative person, and they changed the way that the school worked when I was there. And when you got to the options bit, you couldn't just choose the subjects you wanted. You had to pick a course.
Right.
So it was caring or catering or the boys one, which did all the sort of like woodwork, metalwork, things like that, and girls weren't allowed to do it.
No.
Or because I'd actually done really well academically, up until then I'd got like 98% in my maths and things like that. So I had to do this academic course, which was all of the humanities and sciences and things. And there was only one option to do something creative.
Which was?
Either art or needlework. So
right.
I went for the art option, seeing as I was already making my school uniform. And that was just because I needed to get into college, and that was all I wanted school for, was to get me four A-levels to qualify to get to college.
Right.
And do fashion design. But school wasn't great. I didn't enjoy it at all.
Oh. And you went to college then?
Yeah, straight from school. Didn't do A-levels or anything because I just knew that's what I wanted to do. So
okay.
I went to Croydon College, which it's not sort of like high profile, but in the industry it's got a good reputation because you are taught all aspects of fashion design.
Okay.
So everything from business, basic business knowledge, to history of fashion, to pattern cutting, designing and making, not just one section of that. So I did that for 2 years.
And which bit of that did you like the best?
It wasn't one bit, because I liked all of it.
You liked all of it?
I like all of it, yeah. The only one that I did sort of bunk off was life drawing, but that's because we had a very strange model and I was only 16 still.
And you didn't like it?
Didn't like it,
no.
It was a bit awkward, shall we say. But it was okay. But apart from that, I had a really good time after school because I finally found people that understood what I liked and what I enjoyed, and we could talk about things, whereas people didn't really get me up until that point.
Do they ever get you?
Not really. But now I do. Now there's many people. You know, the thing about sewing, you know, with the classes, it brings people together who have this one thread, literally thread, that brings them all together, and they can be from different walks of life, different ages, different careers, but we can all talk about fabric and get excited about it.
Okay. So you left college, then what?
Then I wanted to go to further, you know, get a degree or something, but financially just couldn't do it. I did get a job for about 6 months in it was an evening wear design, a design studio, but it was very sweatshop kind of scenario. You know, it was £50 a week. The woman I worked for was Austrian, and she would go away for 3 weeks Christmas. I would have to make up my time if I wanted to be paid for it.
Right.
So I would have to work an extra 3 weeks worth of hours to get £150.
Right.
And I was pretty much left on my own, and it just wasn't what I wanted to do. But it was really hard to then know where to go.
Yeah.
You know, we had no way of like nowadays you can go on Instagram, you can contact people direct. We couldn't really do that.
No.
So I ended up literally just so that I could earn money by going into retail. It did actually, though, teach me so much. I went in as just sales assistant, but my manager at the time, she saw and she could see there was an extra bit of creativity there.
There was more to you.
Yeah, so she got me in doing the visual merchandising, which was helping out with the windows, but doing the in-store merchandising, so laying out of stock and doing all the displays within the shop.
Oh, yeah.
And that was great. And I ended up getting promoted to the West End, to the flags store in Oxford Circus, and did that for a little while. And then I don't know why, but I thought I needed to progress. So I went into management and changed from H&M to Wallis, which again was great. And I learned so much, you know, the psychology of retail, cashing up and using, you know, that side of it, and budgeting and stock loss. And all of those sort of sides of retail.
Stock loss is?
Are people stealing your things.
Oh, right. Okay.
And how to prevent them stealing your things, because it's down to the manager. It's part of your budgets and targets to make sure people don't steal things mm-hmm. out of the shop, which, as you've just sort of proved the point, lots of people don't understand that that is, you know, a major part of it.
It is, yeah. So
I did that for a few years, and I started as assistant manager and got to manager in Bromley. And then life sort of went a little bit sort of squiffy. I at that point, we had a really horrible area manager who wanted her friend in my position.
Right.
So no matter what I did, no matter what targets I broke, it was never good enough. And she piled on the pressure all the time. And at that point, I was beginning to physically feel stressed.
I think you would, yeah.
Also in a bad relationship at the time, which didn't help. And ended up, I tried going somewhere else. I went to French Connection for about a year. But at the age of 25, I was too old. Yeah.
Too old?
I felt too old, yes.
Right.
So,
because they're aiming at teenagers?
Well, at the time, you know, it was just a feeling. You felt that, you know, you were looked on and sort of it was a bit like, you're a bit old for this gig kind of thing. But everything else that was going on personally. And I ended up leaving there. And then I was doing... I'd got in touch with a guy in Petswood who was an interior designer.
All right.
And I was then doing the curtain making and all of the making for him, which was nice because I could do it from home. And then I was working in Boots in the afternoon as just a kind of backup.
Yeah.
And to get me out of the house for a bit as well.
Yes.
And did that for about 5 years.
So you moved to the Isle of Wight?
Moved to the Isle of Wight. We'd always come over as kids,
yes,
and loved it. And there was a point where my sister nearly moved over, but just for some reason didn't.
Yeah.
It felt a safe place to live because I was going to be on my own.
Mm-hmm.
So it felt like a nice, safe place to go. It was not too far from everything at home. And it felt like I needed to do something quite drastic.
Yeah.
Financially, it's always cheaper over here than it was back home as
yeah.
well. And that was that. So, and with Boots, I actually could transfer.
Right.
So it meant I did have a job for a while when I first moved over.
In Newport?
I was in Sandown for a little while and then went to Shanklin.
Oh, right.
Yeah, I was there for about a year and a half, something like
doing
that.
Doing sales, was it?
Yeah, I was a bit of everything. And I'd also, when I was in, when I was on the mainland, I had started to... learn to be dispenser.
Right.
And, you know, an assistant dispenser and learn all about that side of it. So because I can't remember what level I'd got to, but I'd got to whatever level it was where I could actually come over and help out in there, obviously supervised and
yeah.
everything else. But
yeah.
it meant I could do that as well as merchandising and display from my other experiences.
Yeah. Can't be bad, can it? So from Boots, where did you go? Or did you carry on there and do something else as well at the same time?
No, it was a real sort of out of the blue moment. There was an advert in the paper for workers to for a company that wanted seamstresses to work making costumes.
Oh, right.
And it was a full-time position and I was full-time at Boots. But I thought I'd just sort of inquire to see if they had anything that I could say do at home alongside the boots thing. Ended up going for the interview, and it was only a full-time job, and I had no idea what it was for anything. I wasn't sure, you know, what kind of costume making it would be.
Right.
Thinking it might just be cruise ships, something along those lines.
Yeah. Just cruise ships. I mean, well, they have zillions
but
of
I,
costumes.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But I just sort of thought, you know, I'd just be one of many minions sewing. Anyway, it turned out that it was a man called John Sheward, and he had moved down recently from mainland. He used to be based in Brixton. And he did a lot of West End film costumes.
Oh, right.
Lion King was their sort of main show that they did. And they did that in lots of European countries as well.
Stage version.
Yeah. 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 And in the past, he'd done a lot of TV work when he was based in London, like entertainment, like Kenny Everett and Two Ronnies, those kind of shows. And also, he'd done Michael Flatley's costumes as well when he did Riverdance, Lord of the Dance. So I went for the interview, not really expecting much. And they offered me the job because they knew about Croydon College and the reputation that had. And said, let's give it a go, see how we get on. And I stayed there for 9.5 years.
Didn't do badly then?
It was all right. It was okay, yeah.
And what was the most famous thing you made, do you think?
In a sideways thing, the best, most famous film we did was Pirates of the Caribbean 2.
Oh, right.
Pirates of the Caribbean 2, and we did the cannibals that were on the island.
They didn't wear a lot, did they?
Not a lot, but we had to make headdresses.
Oh, right.
Sort of grass skirts. We had to do sort of wristbands, necklaces, things like that, which was made from sort of grasses, dried grasses, things like that.
Yeah.
And also, because they were cannibals, they had to have bones. So we would have doctors' skeletons, you know, normally having a surgery, take them apart, make them all sort of bloodied and dirty and put hair on them and make them into jewellery.
Wow.
Yes, which was fun. It was we did 150 altogether costumes.
Sounds like it was an expert job.
It was an unusual job, an unusual one.
Not one you expected.
No, not normal sewing. There was hardly any sewing involved, but it was lots of gluing and sticking and just sort of very Blue Peter.
But, play school, yeah.
Yeah, but it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, the only downside was if we'd been on the first film, we would have been in the Caribbean making them, and the second one, I was in Ventnor in the winter.
Oh,
not quite the same.
Oh, dear.
No.
Anyway, we'll take a break there now and have some adverts. We'll be back with you in a minute.
Vectis Radio.
Well, we're back after the adverts with Karen. Did you get to meet Johnny Depp?
No.
In Ventnor?
No, we didn't meet any of them. I wish we had done, but no, didn't meet anybody.
Were they pleased with the outcome of all the bits you
missed? I think so. I mean, they were all on the film, so that was pretty good. You always know you've done well if they actually make it to the screen. Many a time things get cut and you never see them again.
Yeah.
But
4 days doing a 30-second thing and then cut it completely.
Yeah, absolutely. We did a King Arthur film and we did the Saxon Warriors. And obviously, you've got to be true to the period, which is difficult when it's the Dark Ages, because there is no reference, hence it being Dark Ages. But you couldn't show things like machines stitching, but you've still got to make it so these things are sturdy and durable from when they're filming and things.
Yeah.
So there was lots of sort of using leather, ties and things like that and sort of metal bits and lots of dyeing of leather was involved with that.
A lot of imagination involved, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. I mean, and it works in very different ways with costume making, and it's depending on who the designer is. Some of them would give you a mood board, so just with pictures and images of the type of thing they're looking for, and then it was up to us to interpret it.
Right.
Which is how it worked with Pirates of the Caribbean 2. And it worked the same pretty much with the King Arthur. And it was just then we were given loads of material, which wasn't fabric, it was things.
Please make something.
Yeah, but it wasn't fabric, it was things like leather, but then it was things like fur. And it was all, we found out it was all byproducts, most of it from France. Things like boar, goat, reindeer, fox, which didn't sit 100% well, but it was, you know, the job that we had to do. It didn't smell very nice, actually, as well.
Did it all turn out all right?
Yeah, again, that was brilliant. That was great, which, yeah, that was really, it really looks effective. But, you know, we were really sort of conscious about sticking to it being looking quite sort of, you know, genuine.
Yeah.
And then when you watch the film, there's one point where you see a close-up of a boot and it's like a Doc Martin. Yeah, I didn't have those in the dark ages. Because at least, like, put a bit of leather around it or something.
You'd have thought so.
You would have thought so.
Yeah.
But, yeah, and then other jobs that we did, lots of sort of ballet and opera, it was very much you had a sketch from the designer.
Right.
And then it had to be exactly the same.
Yeah.
With Disney, they're very, very strict. So when we were doing Lion King, every production has to be exactly the same. So whether you go to the one in China, in Australia, the one in the US, all of the Zumba characters have to have exactly the same thing. So we got to a point, though, that we were doing the Zumba, the Simba, adult and child, Timon, Pumbaa, and there's one called Bird Soloist. And the UK, because the UK has got such a great reputation for costume makers, it's become the standard. So all of the other productions have to be as good as the UK London version.
Oh, right.
Yeah, which was really, really good that we were part of that.
Yeah.
There's so much more involved.
Didn't that make you feel proud?
Oh, God, yeah. When you went to see, you know, we went to see the show, and that actually then gave me the confidence to sort of do what I'm doing now, because you can kind of go, I made that.
Yeah.
You know, and people are seeing it and things like that. So it was, I learned so much doing that. I mean, it has to be, it's really stressful, really like hard work, but very, you know, satisfying at the end of it. But it's, you know, the deadlines are just so strict.
Yeah.
But you're always waiting, like you're waiting for someone else to buy the fabric or someone else to do the dyeing.
Yeah.
But the dyers are waiting for the fabric to be bought. They've got to go and get it from wherever.
So it's like a chain reaction.
Yeah, and the thing is, you've got, say, 6 months to do a production. That opening night will stay regardless of what happens.
Yeah.
So you think, yeah, we've got 6 months, but
we don't want any naked performers.
Yeah, if the fabric's delayed, then the dye-in's delayed, you know, and there's only so much you can do with prototyping.
And you've got to work 27 hours a day.
And you do end up doing that. You know, there have been moments where the courier was walking up the driveway and there's five of us sewing buttons on, you know, and so one would be sort of nominated to go out and sort of delay the courier.
Yeah.
You know, hi, lovely day, you know, sort of thing, so we could get it finished, get it into a box and get it sent off. So it can be stressful. And it was very intense, and I did find that physically my body was beginning to get painful.
I think it was.
Yeah, too much sort of sewing in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
I loved it, but then after sort of 9.5 years, I just sort of lost the spark of it and wanted to do something a bit different.
Were there any other shows you made costumes for?
Spamalot was quite a fun one. Again, it's quite sort of such a shame that I didn't actually meet the people I made things for, because it was Tim Curry, you know, while he was still just wonderful. We did a production called Love Never Dies, which was the follow-up to Phantom of the Opera.
Right.
And that was great. We did Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, when that was first out in the West End, and that was for Jason Donovan.
We didn't meet any of them.
But he's got a very, very small waist.
Is he?
Very small waist, yeah.
Oh, right.
But, yeah, made stuff for him. The first one that we did, when I first joined, the first proper, like from beginning to end, first job that I saw all the way through was Carmen at Glyndebourne.
Right.
And it was very famous opera singer.
Right.
She was wonderful. And there was lots of corsetry in that.
Were there many costumes that she had during the performance?
She had, she had quite a few. And you would also, with costumes as well, you've also got to make the same costume sometimes a couple of times because you've got to have it at the beginning while it's still clean and fresh. And then you've got to get one that's like, say, they're caught in the rain or, that kind of thing. But, yeah, there was sort of the tobacco factory, which is a white corset and a white petticoat, which then gets distressed with things like graters and tea bags. So your beautiful white costume you'd made.
So it looks like it's been in the tea factory. Yeah. The tobacco factory.
Absolutely, yeah. And then there was one where the next costume where she's in the cafe, restaurant, whatever it is. And then the one at the end where it's a real proper sort of Spanish, all lace and roses and things. And so there's quite a few throughout the production. But we just did hers for that one.
Yeah.
And that was nice because I did actually go to the fitting in Glyndebourne, which is a place I'd always wanted to go to. And I met her and that was lovely.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
Another thing to be proud of.
Yeah. Yeah.
And where did you go from there?
When I left John. So I while I was still at John's, my best friend, got married. And I said, I'm not making a dress because it would be too stressful. And I didn't want to mess up my friendship.
Right.
But she did persuade me to make her veil. Partly because we went to a wedding dress shop and we were outraged at how much the veil was and for what you got for it.
Yeah.
So I made a veil and then for her wedding. And then from then on sort of started exploring what was available or what wasn't available. And decided to sort of try my hand at a bit of bridal.
Mm-hmm.
Did that for a couple of years whilst still working for John. But then at that point, it was a case of something had to kind of give. I either had to stop doing that because you just didn't have the time to do both.
No.
And I got to a big birthday and thought, time to do something on my own. So that was what I did. I left my costume job and started up my own business. It's called Karen Dornelli, which was named after my maternal grandmother.
Right.
Found out she was a trainee milliner. She died very, very young, though. My mum was only 3 when she passed away.
That's a shame.
So we don't know much about her, but the photo we have of her, I look very much like her. So I feel like I'm tapping into her creativity.
Right. You didn't want to be a milliner then?
No, because I'd already sort of started the veil, and then we found out about the millinery, which was just a bit sort of strange. So I was sort of doing that for a while, and then branched out into alterations for bridal dresses, and then through the Facebook and things like that, I found this group of people on the mainland, and all over sort of south of England. Photographer, cake maker, florist. And we would get together and do a photo shoot every now and then.
All right.
Just so that we could sort of spread the word about our businesses and who we were and do something a bit more creative.
Were they normal photo shoots or did you have quirky ones? Or?
Very quirky. We had a Harajuku one, which
what's that?
Japanese, right. The sort of Hello Kitty themes.
All right.
With the first one, though, was the My really, really good friend, Gwenda, who, as a result of this, really became a good friend. She was the stylist and the florist. And she would give us the theme and then we'd all individually go away and go, what? But then we would all come together on the day and it would just work. It was just really, really just the best sort of feeling that we'd all kind of channeled the same sort of ideas and they all came together and worked. But the first one was called Steampunk Scientist, Mad Steampunk Scientist. So I was like, and at this point, I'd sort of said, can I start making dresses? So it wasn't just the veil. So I said, have we got someone to make the dresses? And they had someone, but for some reason that fell through. So I sort of stepped in and said, right, I'm going to do that. And then that started me on the road to making my own designs. So yeah, Mad Steampunk Scientist. We had lots of little test tubes, which were sort of the drinks, but they had dry ice bubbling out of them. And it was very, very quirky.
So where did you photograph that?
It was in a studio in Crystal Palace.
Yep.
Yeah, it was very, very nerve-wracking because the first time I'd met all these creative people. But the best day, absolutely. And the photos that came out were brilliant.
Well, Room for the Creatives, is that good?
Yeah.
Can it be good?
Yeah, it can.
Can it be awful?
No, it can be. I think most of the time it is good.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, as long as you all know where you all are, I suppose.
And what
you're
doing.
Yeah,
and,
there wasn't anyone who was more important than anyone else.
No.
We all understood that, you know, as a designer, you need someone to take your photographs. You need someone to wear your dress. You need somebody to do the makeup and the hair. And that has to sit. If that's wrong, then your dress is wrong.
Yeah.
If the cake doesn't match the theme, it doesn't work.
No.
So everybody in that kind of situation is as important as everyone else.
Absolutely, yeah.
And we all got on and we ended up doing quite a few shoots. You know, we would then do another one sort of 6 months later and pick it, and Gwenda would just sort of say, right, this is the next theme, let's go with it. And we did a Queen of Hearts. We did a Valentine's one, which was like a 1920s flapper style.
Yeah.
The Harajuku one, which I think was the craziest one. That one was bonkers.
Were they all shot in the same place?
No, some of them were sort of various places around Kent. That sort of way. There's one on the beach, I think it was a Canberra. There was one I didn't get to, and it was full of mosquitoes and everybody got very, very bitten.
Oh dear.
And I was the only one who escaped because I couldn't make it over.
Yes, mosquitoes are horrid, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah, they always remember that one. And the one on the beach was very windy, so there was lots of sand in faces and things. But you wouldn't know looking at the photos.
No, I bet.
You would not know.
Not brilliant. Know at
all. Yeah.
And then what?
So then I went down the bridal rabbit hole for a good few years, 15 mm-hmm. years it's been. Designing was sort of the aim, my own designs, but It's very hard to do that sort of thing, especially on the Isle of Wight. There's not enough of a market for people wanting their own things. So I got a studio and started actually selling pre-loved. There was a bit of a market for that because there's lots of ladies who, you know, buy their wedding dress, they've only worn it once, and then what do you do with it? You know, it's a hard thing to sort of store. And there was lots of ladies who wanted to have somebody else enjoy their wedding dress. So that was my role, was to make sure people had still a bridal experience when they bought their wedding dress, but could save some money.
So they didn't have to spend too much, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and it was just nice to not sort of perpetuate the cycle of buying new and throwing it out. It meant it was going back into being reused and reworn and reloved. And exactly. Some of the dresses were worn a couple of times, which was really lovely.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
We're going to take another little break now and we'll be back with you in a few minutes.
Vectis Radio.
We're back again after the adverts.
Hello again.
And you've been making wedding dresses and you've been selling pre-loved.
Yes.
How did that go?
It went really well until the joy of COVID.
Oh, yes.
That put the kibosh on all of it.
Put the kibosh on a lot of things,
absolutely.
Didn't it?
So I had to reassess. All the way through, though, when I left my full-time job, I was teaching adults how to sew.
Oh, right.
Had a couple of sort of regular classes. And that has sort of pretty much sustained me throughout everything that I've done. It's always been there. It's always been a constant. And
what did you do during COVID? Nothing? Or could you do things online? Or
we did scrub making.
You did? Yes.
We did scrub making. We were called upon by Mountbatten initially to make 100 sets of scrubs.
Right. From what?
From
what? What did you make them from?
Oh, from at the time, we didn't have anything.
Right.
That was part of the problem. So
it was like the King's New Clothes, was it?
Yeah, well, there was a lot of sort of conversations and sort of things going on. And initially when it came, you know, it came about we needed to do this. Because obviously it wasn't just Mountbatten, it was NHS in general.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of regulations involved as to what fabric could be used, how they needed to be made, and things like that.
Right.
Which, understandably, you know, needed to be correct. But everywhere ran out of fabric.
Well, they would, wouldn't they?
Exactly. And we needed more than we could produce. And there was a lot of sort of to-ing and fro-ing with, well, can we use this, can we use that? It was all a bit of red tape, and at the end of the day, we just wanted to help people.
Yes.
So I then recruited initially my sewing students, because they were all at home, wanted something to do, wanted to do some sewing. So we had sort of a few sort of donated sheets and things that we used. And we made the first 100 for Mountbatten within a couple of days. And then we were like, okay, now what do we do? Then we'd realised through friends of mine, friends of friends who were working in the care homes, that they were also struggling to get the PPE.
Right.
So they weren't that concerned what they were made from.
Right.
It then meant, so then we said, well, look, everyone's at home. Those that can sew want to do something. Those that can't sew still want to help. So they cleared out their cupboards and they sent us all their sheets, duvet covers, pillowcases, fabric, anything. We then ended up with a really huge team, whereas myself and my friend Tracy were at the Rookley Methodist Hall, and that was our hub. And from there, we would organise drivers who were volunteers, Hose Road Dixon mostly, but other people. And what we would organise was they would go and collect the fabrics.
Yes.
From each individual person, mm-hmm. from their driveway, bring it to us. We would sort through it, make sure it was usable and clean, or also keep it there for 72 hours to make sure it was then safe to carry on. And then the drivers would then deliver that to the people who wanted to sew. Then, obviously, we needed them collected once they were sewn. They would come back to us. We would sort them, and then we would send them out to the care homes. So it actually became a full-time job. We just did all of the sorting and the organising, and the drivers were in and out. And we ended up with nearly 3,000 sets of scrubs, plus over 1,000 scrub bags, plus over 1,000 masks. And the nice thing about it was it wasn't just about the PPE that was going out. It was the fact that we were helping people at home have a purpose.
Yes.
Something to get up for,
some
kind of routine for their day.
Yeah.
They were also in contact with people over the phone or over email. The drivers, when they were picking up or dropping off, they would have a bit of a conversation, you know, what's going on out in the real world, things like that.
Socially distanced, of course.
Oh, gosh, yeah, no, it's, you know, literally at the end of the gate, you know, they would sort of drop it at the door, walk to the end of the gate and just chat through there and all of the regulations were adhered to, but you could still do things. You could still contact people. Yeah. You could still have that
point
of contact.
That's vitally important, isn't it?
And it was also things like, you know, it was kind of, oh, we need some milk. Well, I'll get some on the way in if you want. You know, there was lots of that sort of going on. And for me, because I live on my own. My friend Tracy was on her own. So we became like a bubble ourselves, just the two of us. So it gave us purpose, you know, to get up in the morning and things. And we just, but the things that were being made, they weren't just being, you know, slammed together.
No.
They were beautifully made, you know, and we would get little notes in there.
All different sizes.
Yeah, different sizes. But they would be very creative. You know, Tracy told me off initially. She worked in bridal, in weddings, doing decor and things like that. And I was just putting bags of fabric together, and she was getting very irate with me because I wasn't colour matching. So we had to colour coordinate. But what it meant was when things came back, they were a set, you know, and it was like the pocket was, you know, a beautifully cut piece of flower or something, you know. So that when the care home got them, they would have coordinated sets, coordinated wardrobes.
Yes.
So it was lovely, and the feedback we got from them, from the patients, was, you know, it brightened their day. They weren't getting visitors. You know, all they were getting were the staff coming to visit them. But if they were wearing something really bright, and, you know, we had Christmas avocados. We had Superman, we had Star Wars.
Dinosaurs.
You know, there was so many, because we were using duvet covers.
Yeah.
And it just sort of brightened their day. It meant that people wearing them felt a little bit more brighter. So it just worked all around.
Yeah.
When we got to the stage where it was sort of like we could go out, but we couldn't go out, and lots of people still didn't want to.
Yeah.
But we didn't want any more scrub making. We then had loads of pillowcases left over. So there was a scheme where pillowcases were made into little girls' dresses and then sent to African, you know, and sent abroad to help kids over there. But we were like, nah, let's not just do dresses. Let's do more than that. So actually we would give people the sort of the smaller pieces and they would make trousers and a whole like little capsule wardrobe for kids. Aww. And then we got them sent to, it was either the Ivory Coast or somewhere like that. And that was through the Rotary. And we ended up with an exhibition at Key Arts to sort of celebrate everything that people had done, because we just felt people needed to know what went on at home. You know, it wasn't just people doing their gardening and things. There were other things going on that were helping other people.
Yeah.
So that was that. And then.
And since then?
Then we had to go back to work.
Yeah.
So since then, it's pretty much been my classes have taken over. You know, they've always been there, but now they're primary. They're my sort of
so
number
one. Sewing machine classes or is it hand sewing?
Most of it's sewing machine. Yeah. Most of it's that. There are a few odd sort of hand sewing things we do as well. We get other people to come in now and do teaching.
All right.
Bra making, quilting, that kind of thing. The studio I had in Newport was too small to still do the social distancing. So I'm now welcoming you to my new studio in over at the Isle of Wight Pearl.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a much bigger space. We've got parking outside, you don't have to pay, you don't have to clock watch.
Yeah.
You can just come in and enjoy your sewing.
Yeah.
And I've now got 4 regular classes, which are always full. Hardly ever have a space. And they come and people stay with me now for years. You know, a lot of them I've had now for good sort of 5 years or so.
And they make something different each time?
Oh, they're doing amazing stuff. They're self-drafting patterns. They're making the most beautiful bags. We've got leather jackets going on at the moment. We've got a 1940s coat going on. They really don't realise how brilliant they are. You know, they don't realise how far they've come. And it's just great. I just sit back and watch them and point out things occasionally. But then we've also got workshops that we do, which are for beginners.
Right.
For pattern cutters, you know, that specialise in specific parts of the sewing process.
Right, yeah.
So we, you know, we've got the regular ones, but then we've also got other ones for those that can't do the regular ones, who can just dip in and out. And then as well as 3 years ago, I actually took on the dealership for Brother Sewing Machines.
Oh, right, yes.
So now we have a shop which sells those. We've got an engineer who can do any servicing, repairs for any brand of domestic sewing machines. And we are growing a library of fabric so that people can come in and pick some fabric, get matching threads, zips, haberdashery. We do gifts and everything. So kind of
not
growing
much
that.
Then.
No. So it's quite boring, really.
No. It sounds fascinating. So it's like haberdashery shop.
Yeah.
As well as a sewing shop.
Yeah, yeah. It's definitely into two. We are branching into two separate businesses now. So we've got the workshop, which is the classes, and that side of it. So,
do you have a vast supply of fabrics, or is it just samples and then you order
There's samples. That way we give you more choice.
Yes.
So rather than picking one colour of a fabric, because you have to buy a whole roll,
we
can get the samples in all of the colours.
Right.
And then you can buy it by the metre or there's a 2 metre minimum. But it means you can get the exact colour you want.
Yeah.
And the exact quantity that
you want.
Sounds
good, doesn't it?
Yeah, it just gives people more choice. You know, you are paying a little bit more, but at least you don't have to go online and guess. You know, you can actually
see... It doesn't always look the same, does it, on screen?
It's a feel of it as well. Mm. You know, the colour is never the same, especially if you're trying to match things up. But it's also feeling the quality of fabric. You know, you need to see how it drapes and how thick it is. And because, you know, even myself, if I'm looking at it, because things are you know, poly cotton mix, that could mean anything.
Yeah.
You know, you don't know exactly how that, the finish on that is. You know, because sometimes you'll get them with a finish on it that makes it crisper. Sometimes you'll, and it's the polyester to cotton
ratio.
Percentage. Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's so many other fabrics out there now that you can get.
Right.
And also sort of tapping into things like eco fabrics. So yes. Recycled polyesters.
Yeah.
You know, there's sort of that you can get fabrics made from. Obviously bamboo, quite
yes.
a popular one, but you
yes.
can get them made from oranges and bananas
yeah.
and milk. You can make fabrics.
It's amazing,
from,
isn't it, and, what they can do
yeah,
now.
It's incredible now yeah. what's available.
So what would you say to people who are, say, 14, 15, and they've got choices to make? Do you think, would you advise them to follow their heart and go with what they want to do, or go to university when they don't want to go to university, or what would you advise?
It's very hard because I think if you're creative, you do need a sound background in education. You do need to be able to do it. People, you know, people go, well, why would I ever need Pythagoras? In pattern cutting, you need it. Circumference of a circle, triangles, measurements, angles, right angles. You need all of that.
Yeah.
So it is a case of finding, if you are going to university, finding the right course for what it is you want to do. You can, like, say, for example, with sort of sewing, I mean, you know, I've done costume making, I've done home furnishings, I'm doing my own thing now and I'm doing teaching. Once you get into an industry like costume making, even within that, there is so many different branches.
Yeah.
So it's kind of learn the skills that you need. So, like, learn how to sew.
Yeah.
You know, learn the basics of whatever it is. And whether that's learning it outside of a school situation or in a school situation or a university situation. But then be open. You know, I never realised how wide the costume world was.
No.
You know, you've got people who specialise in ballet, people who specialise in menswear, in female, in the more quirkier stuff, in dancewear. Even just, there's just tutu makers.
Yeah.
You know, and then you've also got the supervisors, who are the people who work between the designer and the makers. You know, the designers don't make it, they design it, they draw the pictures, they have the vision. Then you've got supervisors who, you know, they do the in-between bits, they find the right maker for the right job.
Yeah.
And then they've got assistants who do things like, right, this is the list of things we need to buy, we need to go and source this.
Yeah.
You've also got dressers, you've also got people who maintain costumes in theatres.
They're vital, aren't they?
Absolutely. And they're all, you know, it's not as glamorous as you think. You know, there's a lot of hard work, and that's the other thing is
don't... But if you love it,
go and do it. Definitely go and do it.
Yeah.
And even if you don't know quite what it is you want to do, but you know it's involving that, try and get into it in some other way.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes...
And you can see what's available.
Exactly, and it's making contact with people. Sometimes going to university or college is good for the contacts you make because you get work experience.
Absolutely.
Those are the things that are really important. So, you know, it's you learn so much at college, but you learn more by meeting people.
Yes. So, do you have a favourite track that we can play at the end of this?
My favourite track,
yes.
I would say... I'm a bit of a dance
lady.
Entrance, Set Me Free.
Okay. That shall be played.
Thank you. That's my favourite dance.
Thank you for that, Karen.
No,
it's
thank
been
you.
Absolutely fascinating.
Thank you for coming over.
Pleasure.
If you would like to hear this or any other of the conversations again, go to the Vectis Radio webpage, vectisradio.com, and you can find it amongst the podcasts.
Your support matters. We operate thanks to the support of local businesses. If you would like to advertise on Vectis Radio, FM 104.6, contact our team today. Marketing at vectisradio.fm.